Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen F. Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University in Princeton, who takes a critical look at U.S. corporate media's one-dimensional coverage of protests in Ukraine over that nation's trade policies. Mark Coville, the New Haven Catholic worker, who explains why he and two other peace activists made the decision to risk arrest at a December 9th protest against U.S. drone attacks at Hancock U.S. Air Force Base near Syracuse, New York. And Laura McLeary, legislative director with the National Nurses United Union, who assesses the lack of fairness she sees in the House-Senate budget plan and alternatives to the continued national focus on austerity policies. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a surprise ruling, India's Supreme Court restored the nation's legal ban on gay sex that dates back to colonial times. The court overruled a 2009 decision by the Delhi High Court, which said the law did not apply to consensual acts. April Gopalan, who has campaigned for over a decade to repeal the ban on gay sex, blasted the ruling, saying, "This is taking many, many steps back. The Supreme Court has not only let down the LGBT community, but the Constitution of India." The ban on gay sex was rarely enforced in India, but is a strong reminder of the country's conservative attitude towards sexuality and gender. Ironically, India has a rich cultural tradition of sexual diversity and honoring eunuchs and transgendered people. The ban on gay sex, dating back to 1861, imposes a 10-year sentence for sex among same-sex couples. Since their independence, Australia, Fiji, Hong Kong, and New Zealand have repealed similar bans. In its ruling, India's Supreme Court declared it was the responsibility of Parliament to repeal the ban on gay sex. Short-term prospects for a reversal in Parliament look bleak, as polls predict victory for the conservative Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in upcoming elections this spring. President Barack Obama's brief handshake with Cuban President Raul Castro at a memorial service for Nelson Mandela in South Africa made world headlines. It was the first public contact between a U.S. president and a Cuban leader in 13 years, and set off an immediate frenzy among anti-Castro Miami politicians and right-wing pundits. On Capitol Hill, Florida Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Leighton quizzed U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry about whether Obama's handshake meant a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban relations, which has remained frozen in Cold War policy. Kerry insisted nothing had changed in U.S. enforcement of the embargo on Cuba. But President Obama raised expectations of change when he recently referenced U.S.-Cuba relations by stating, "We have to find new mechanisms and new tools." Arizona Senator John McCain went so far as to compare Obama's handshake with Raul Castro with the handshake between British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and Hitler prior to World War II. For now, U.S.-Cuban relations remain stuck over the imprisonment of U.S. citizen Alan Gross, a former subcontractor for the U.S. Agency for International Development, who brought internet equipment onto the island nation in violation of Cuban law. Cuba is working to link Gross's detention with the case of the Cuban Five, Cuban agents who were convicted in U.S. courts of spying on American-based Cuban exile groups engaged in violent attacks on Cuba. During his 2010 campaign, Florida Republican Governor Rick Scott promised to create 700,000 jobs to kickstart the Sunshine State's economy. Once in office, he directed hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks and other incentives to businesses to create those jobs. But according to a joint investigation of the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, few jobs were created by Governor Scott's business tax breaks. While Florida funds were targeted to create 45,258 new jobs, 96% of those jobs have not yet materialized, according to state data. In spite of Scott's poor record in leveraging tax incentives, Florida's unemployment rate has fallen below the national average, and over 400,000 private sector jobs have been created. But the new employment numbers can't be attributed to Scott's tax programs, owing rather to positive trends after the Great Recession. In fact, the total number of new jobs Scott ultimately might deliver doesn't offset the jobs lost. According to federal unemployment data, between January 2011 and November 2013, large Florida employers reported nearly 50,000 layoffs. Governor Scott's record on job creation, now being scrutinized, will certainly be a key issue when the unpopular GOP incumbent runs against his predecessor, Republican-turned-Democrat Charlie Crist, in Florida's November 2014 election. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
For weeks, tens of thousands of demonstrators have gathered in Kiev's Independence Square to protest Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych's recent decision to delay or drop plans to sign an association trade agreement with the European Union. The protests calling for the dismissal of Ukraine's government and new elections are the largest since the 2004 Orange Revolution. U.S. Senator John McCain, the GOP's 2008 presidential candidate, traveled to Kiev on December 15th, where he spoke to protesters strongly expressing his support for their cause. Tensions rose soon after President Yanukovych put off signing the EU agreement and instead began talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who's putting together his own customs union trade bloc. On December 17th, Putin and Yanukovych announced a joint economic plan of action that included plans for Moscow to buy $15 billion in Ukrainian debt and a reduction by almost half the price Ukrainians pay for Russian-supplied gas. The Ukrainian nation is divided by language, culture, and religion, where half the country in the east identifies with Russia, and the western half believes its future is brighter with closer ties to Europe. The concern among many Ukrainians is that signing an agreement with the EU would mandate austerity policies that could trigger high unemployment and diminish the market in Russia for its eastern-based heavy industry and coal mining. Since the demise of the Soviet Union, Moscow has expressed concern that the eastern expansion of the EU and the NATO military alliance constitutes a grave threat to Russian security. Your reporter spoke with Stephen F. Cohen, professor emeritus in Russian studies and politics at New York University in Princeton, who takes a critical look at U.S. corporate media's one-dimensional coverage of Ukraine's trade issues and Senator McCain's provocative actions during his recent visit to Kiev.
It's gone beyond irony with McCain. I think it's a kind of obscenity and a disgrace for American elected officials to behave as they do. It's not only McCain. He's been accompanied by the Democratic senator from Connecticut. I think his name is Christopher Murphy. And the Democratic senator from Connecticut said he was with McCain to show bipartisan support for this. In fact, almost all of America's unwise policy toward Russia since the Soviet Union ended in 1991 has been bipartisan. It began with Clinton. It went to Bush. The Congress has pretty much backed anything the president, whether Republican or Democratic, did. But in the case of McCain, there's something just wacky about this. This is not the first time he's done that. He liked to go to the former Soviet Republic of Georgia before 2008. And the things he said there, not only McCain but others, the late Richard Holbrooke, certainly encouraged President Saakashvili of Georgia to attack the Russian enclave in Georgia, to kill a number of Russian citizens and some UN observers, and lead Russia to come into Georgia in 2008. And if we know fully the story of what happened, we probably came, we the United States, because that was a kind of proxy war, as close to war with Russia as we had since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And yet these people take no responsibility for their action.
Professor Cohen, the U.S. media generally parrots the State Department line and people like Senator John McCain as saying that Russia is bullying Ukraine into dropping its original predilection to go ahead with a European trade agreement. Now Russia's offering some money here. On the other side, the European Union deal offers austerity of the kind that has plagued many of the Western European nations where austerity has been in place with very high unemployment figures. But maybe you could talk about the conflict here in terms of decisions the Ukraine has to make.
Let's back up just a minute because you mentioned the American media and look at the narrative that virtually every American is stuck with. if that American watches mainstream television or reads the mainstream newspapers. First of all, that the signing with the EU would bring democracy to Ukraine, and therefore the protesters in the street are pro-democratic. Secondly, it would bring economic prosperity to Ukraine, because Ukraine would have access to Europe's markets, all the perks of the economic union. Thirdly, it's a civilization choice. That's a phrase often used, that they would escape the Slavic Russian civilization and become, like us, part of Western civilization. And fourth, this is being prevented by Russia's bullying and meddling. Fact is, all four of these bits of the narrative are false or misleading. The protesters in the street are now calling for the overthrow of Yanukovych's government, and they're being supported by the American representatives in Kiev. That was a democratically elected government, both the parliament and the president. And everybody agreed that that election was pretty fair, pretty clean election. It is not democratic to overthrow a democratically elected government. It's the opposite of that. There's an election scheduled for 2015. So the answer to these people is, if you feel that strongly, that you've been betrayed by the government you elected and the parliament you elected in the year 2015, get your electoral act in order and go out and defeat them. But to tell them to try to overthrow, to turn this into a regime change, which has become the policy of the European Union and apparently the State Department, that is anti-democratic. So we are the promoters of anti-democratic action in Ukraine, not the Russians at this stage. As for prosperity, Ukraine is an absolute economic basket case. It needs $18 billion in the next 16 months to avoid going belly up, defaulting on its sovereign debt. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, will give it part of that, but only, as you just said, on the conditions that enact a kind of austerity program, which means cutting social services, means letting people go, it means ending subsidies to people who don't make a sufficient wage, and most Ukrainians make about $150 a month. It would have the kind of impact, but worse, because Ukraine is poorer, as it's had in Spain and Greece. Moreover, do we really believe, does anybody believe, that Ukrainian goods produced in Ukraine are going to be successful in Italy and France and Spain and Germany? This is utter nonsense. And finally, there's a very strong anti-migration movement spreading across Europe. It's highly unlikely that unemployed Ukrainian workers will be welcomed into the European Union. The only country that can help in a practical way, and maybe it would be bad because maybe there would be political conditions, but if we're talking about prosperity, we're talking about economic well-being, it's only Russia. Russia's in a position to give Ukraine very favorable access to all of its markets and to give it discounted energy. What Russia's done is exactly what the EU has done. It's playing economic hardball. Ukraine is for sale. That's what's going on. The government of Yanukovych has been saying, who makes me the best offer? And Russia's making an offer, and the EU's making an offer, and when we last turned the page, Russia's offer was better.
That was Stephen F. Cohen, professor emeritus in Russian studies and politics at New York University in Princeton. He's the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. Find more perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Opposition to drone warfare has been growing in the U.S., as well as in nations around the world, where the bombs from these unmanned aircraft are dropped, often killing and injuring civilians. There have been an increasing number of conferences, demonstrations, and human rights investigations critical of their deployment. On December 9th, three peace activists tried a novel approach. They were arrested as they attempted to deliver an order of protection on behalf of Afghan children and their families at the Hancock U.S. Air Force Base near Syracuse, New York. The base hosts the 174th Attack Wing, from which computer operators pilot the unmanned drones to Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, and other target countries. The three protesters, Mark Colville of the New Haven Catholic Worker and Yale Divinity students Greg Williams and Creighton Chandler, delivered the order of protection, which listed several clauses, including, there shall be no more improper touching of the children of Afghanistan or their families with your Hellfire missiles and your 500-pound bombs. There shall be no more menacing and reckless endangerment of the children and their families. It is further ordered that this order of protection shall remain in force forever. Failure to comply with this order will result in the people's continued nonviolent resistance to this illegal and immoral behavior. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with peace activist Mark Colville shortly after he was released from jail. Here he describes the protest action and explains why he and others are concerned with increasing suppression of the right to dissent.
There has been a number of protests there around the drone situation. Drones are being launched and operated from that airbase, and in this case, they're mostly going to Afghanistan, and there have been large numbers of civilians killed, slaughtered by these drones. They carry Hellfire missiles, and they terrorize the people. Now, I was involved in one of the protests there and a civil disobedience action a year ago, October. That was in 2012. And I still have charges pending for that, believe it or not. But one of the outcomes of that was that the judge, in pretty much an unprecedented move, the judge issued an order of protection on behalf of the base commander, Colonel Earl Evans, against us, against nonviolent protesters. And in effect, what they were trying to do was to squelch our right to free speech, because this order of protection causes a felony charge if it's violated. And having a legal vigil at the airbase would constitute a violation of the order of protection. So one of the ideas that we had as a community was to try to initiate an order of protection on behalf of women and children and families in Afghanistan. A large group of us went to have a legal vigil at the airbase, and then three of us went across the street to the guardhouse to ask for Colonel Evans in order to, actually, I brought him some flowers and a poinsettia. I decided to make light of it to say, hey, we must have gotten off on the wrong foot, but I'd like to patch things up and reconcile with you. So I was asking the guards at the gate to go and get Colonel Evans so we could have a hug together or something. We also held a vigil outside the gate, in front of the gate, with signs indicating that there is an order of protection now in place for the families of Afghanistan. And we were, after about 20 minutes, we were praying and chanting a litany, having to do with the Advent season and the Christian calendar. And we were arrested by state police. So the three of us, Greg Williams, Creighton Chandler, two Yale Divinity School students, and myself, were arrested right in front of the gate. There's a guardhouse and a chain link fence gate there. And so we went there and had our prayer service and asked to see the base commander.
So the three of you were in a different place than the others who were there for the legal protest?
Well, the other people were across the street. That's the lines that they've drawn, that the legal authorities have drawn, that you won't be arrested if you're across the street.
Mark Colville, what were you all charged with?
There were three charges. There was a disorderly conduct charge, a trespass charge, and then a obstruction of government administration, which is a new charge, actually, that I'm not aware of previous groups being charged with. I had the additional charge of what is called contempt. The violation of the order of protection is a contempt charge, and as I understand it, it's a felony charge. And I could face some significant jail time, again, just for doing what is essentially a legal vigil, because it was within 1,000 feet of the place of work of this person. Orders of protection are typically used to protect victims of domestic violence. And so it's a real mockery of the law that a judge, first of all, would allow this to be used in the effort to squelch free speech and legal protest. This has to be challenged. Obviously, not putting aside the fact that innocents are routinely being killed by these drones, but these kinds of incursions on freedom in this country have to be challenged. And so we have to be willing to take some risks for that.
That was Mark Colville of the New Haven Amistad Catholic Worker. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you'll find more information on the Hancock U.S. Air Force Base protest and the growing movement opposing U.S. drone attacks. Congressional negotiators Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, the GOP's 2012 vice presidential candidate, and Democratic U.S. Senator Patty Murray of Washington produced a budget agreement that was applauded in the corporate press as a ceasefire between the nation's two warring political parties and modest progress toward bipartisanship. Their budget bill, which easily passed in the House and handily avoided the threat of a filibuster in the Senate, assuring its passage, would cancel half the across-the-board automatic sequester spending cuts, totaling $63 billion for the current fiscal year. The proposed budget, which avoids a government shutdown in January, makes $85 billion in additional cuts, which results in $23 billion in net deficit reduction over the next decade. But critics of the deal point to the fact that this budget ends federal unemployment insurance benefits to 1.3 million long-term jobless Americans that kicks in just 3 days after Christmas. Others unhappy with the Ryan-Murray budget plan point to proposed cuts that will hit federal workers and members of the military who will be forced to increase monthly payments toward their retirement benefits. What seems obvious to most observers is that the sacrifice called for in this budget impacts those who can least afford it, while nothing is asked of the nation's wealthiest citizens in the form of increased taxes or the closure of lucrative tax loopholes. Your reporter spoke with Laura McLeary, legislative director with the National Nurses United Union, who assesses the lack of fairness she sees in the House-Senate budget plan and alternatives to the continued national focus on austerity measures.
Yeah, people are very quick to mop their brows and declare that the hard work has been done. But it's shocking to us because the latest budget actually represents a very cruel austerity budget. It asks nothing of Wall Street in terms of contributing, and rich people get off scot-free while it raises costs on the middle class and federal workers. It's actually lower in overall spending than the dream 2011 Paul Ryan austerity budget. And so we think he must be delighted. His wish list from 2 years ago is this year's Christmas present. We can think of it as avoiding the utter dysfunction budget. It turns out if you shut down the government, you can continue to exact real pain in terms of the budget outcomes. It contains half the sequester cuts that were unthinkable only a year ago. And so we shouldn't really breathe too deep a sigh of relief that we have a deal. Instead, we need to be taking a lesson from Tea Party activists and reinforcing the things that we don't like. This is really still coal in all of our stockings.
One of the key points that's been a point of contention is the fact that unemployment insurance will be cut off for 1.3 million Americans who've been out of work for quite some time, 3 days after Christmas. Apparently, a deal could not be reached to extend those benefits. What do you make of that, and what are the effects on the economy, do you think?
It's bleak. You know, these are workers that have been looking for work and need these benefits in order to pay their bills. When the workers in a family lose jobs, that can trigger mortgage foreclosure, lost ability to pay medical bills. It can really lead to a system-wide dysfunction in a society. And so, you know, obviously our heart goes out to those 1.3 million workers, plus the 3.6 million who will lose benefits next year under the lack of funding for state programs. It's really a crisis. And what we know is that the unemployment numbers don't really reflect the full employment picture because people who've stopped looking for employment drop out of those numbers. And there are many, many people who are long-term unemployed and who really are facing uncertain financial futures.
Laura McLeary, as you're involved with the union, what kind of outside strategy do you think would be effective or has been effective in sort of case studies where people can push the public debate in a particular direction, a direction opposite of this austerity agenda? What could be done more effectively now in the face of this budget deal to kind of reverse course here and not travel down this same road?
I think we need to push back and push back harder than we have been. We've been letting the Republicans move the goalposts over time, and progressives have not been able to break through with a meaningful countervision to these kinds of austerity frames. We know austerity is harmful. Most economists will tell you that that's the worst thing that you can do in an economic recession, and that stimulative spending is actually far better. And if you look at the example of what's happened around the globe, the European countries that did a lot of spending in the wake of their recessions have recovered, and their economies are humming along nicely, and we continue to limp along. So I think there's ample proof that this austerity direction is the wrong direction. I also think it's true that people are not opposed to government spending on the programs that they love, which is many of them when they're actually named by name. And that's why they say things like, keep the government out of my Medicare. They just don't understand. The government is Medicare. So we need to name names and tell stories about how social supports make a difference in the lives of millions of Americans. And we need to tell the story of the Great Society programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, how they've helped to make this country a middle-class country with shared prosperity and wealth. We now see what an economy of winners and losers look like, and we can talk about that in a way that's compelling and enlist people in a vision for our shared future. The question is, where do we get the money for social spending on programs that we need? And one idea that we've had at National Nurses United is for a Robin Hood tax. This is a tiny tax on Wall Street transactions, 50 cents on $100 worth of trades, and it could raise $350 billion a year. We have a bill in the House of Representatives, H.R. 1579, the Inclusive Prosperity Act, from Representative Ellison and some other members of Congress. And we think this kind of revenue possibility is a conversation changer. It changes the conversation from austerity into possibilities of what we can do with that kind of money, which we could turn around and spend on infrastructure and education. I think in terms of inequality, it directly addresses the problem because you can then have the resources to offer social supports that allow people to take risks by going to school over the long term and building their credentials for a very competitive job market. You can have the social supports that you need so that the elderly and the disabled are taken care of. Those are the preconditions and the major drivers of inequality. And this bill also has the benefit that it would help stabilize the overall economy because the tiny tax helps to disincentivize high-frequency trading. So we view this Robin Hood tax as really, literally, the best-kept secret in Washington. It is the idea that could raise the most revenues of any idea being floated by any of the policy shops. And it's an answer to these ridiculous spectacles of these budget crises. It's really a compelling idea. We just saw a letter from 163 leading economists, including Robert Reich, Bob Polin, Thomas Paley, and others, to Congress saying that this is an obvious win-win solution for the financial markets and for the overall economy.
That was Laura McLeary, legislative director with the National Nurses United Union, the nation's largest organization of registered nurses. For more analysis and commentary on federal budget priorities, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.